dumping oil. It's something of a crash. Oil prices dipping below $120 a barrel yesterday. With demand slumping, the weather cooperating, and speculators losing their shirts, oil just can't get a break. How do you spell energy relief? Party on. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, August 5th. We take a hard look at the dropping oil prices, plus the politics of energy in a presidential election. Well, it makes for some daily tussles. Also, jobs are in abundance if you can climb a ladder, and children and ugly realities. Our friend Freakonomics co-author Stephen Dubner asks, what do you tell your kids about bad stuff? Those stories are coming up, but first, these headlines.
Good morning, Adora.
Good morning, John.
Tropical storm Edward is tearing toward the Texas and Louisiana coasts, bringing heavy rain and winds. Galveston resident Dave Gardner says he's ready.
I spent 18 days after the hurricane came through, Katrina, down in Mississippi, and I was down there when Rita came through, so I'm ready to try another one.
The National Hurricane Center says Edward will probably be near hurricane strength when it hits the Texas-Louisiana state line at around midday today. In northern Illinois, thousands of people are still without power after powerful storms swept through the area last night. Wrigley Field was evacuated because of fears of a tornado, and more than 350 flights were canceled at O'Hare.
The New York Times is reporting that Freddie Mac's chief executive was warned as early as 2004 that the company was buying bad loans. Current and former executives say if the warnings had been heeded, they may have prevented the mortgage giant's current financial troubles. Jose Medellin is appealing the Supreme Court to stay his execution scheduled for tonight. He was convicted in the gang rape and killing of two teenage girls in Houston 15 years ago. His lawyers argue that he wasn't allowed to consult the Mexican's consulate for legal help after his arrest, which may be a violation of a 1963 international treaty.
In what appears to be a policy reversal, Barack Obama is calling for the release of 70 million barrels of oil from the U.S. Strategic Petroleum Reserve to help lower gas prices. A federal task force is recommending doctors stop routine prostate screenings for men over the age of 75. They say most tumors grow so slowly that they never threaten the lives of the men and that treatment may do more harm than good. Some men suffer erectile dysfunction and bladder control problems after treatment.
In politics, John McCain is in Michigan today visiting a nuclear power plant. He then heads to West Virginia. Barack Obama is in Ohio today where he'll focus again on energy.
As we reported, oil prices fell to near $120 a barrel in Asian trading. They dipped below that yesterday in intraday trading. The Dow was down nearly 0.4%, but the markets are looking very happy this morning. Closed at 11,284. The S&P lost 0.9%. It opens this morning at 12:49. We're continuing a discussion we started last week about how do you tell kids about the sort of post-apocalyptic news that's constantly weaving its way into the headlines. We're going to talk with the Freakonomics author Stephen Dubner about the do's and don'ts, the pitfalls of engaging your children in a serious discussion of violent news stories.
Disasters, right. Earthquakes, war,
political violence.
These pictures, yeah. What do you tell them?
8778
My Take.
Or My Take at thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. Well, we got you out of bed with the thought of dumping oil. Volatility in the oil markets is where we begin this morning. Oil traded at one point below $120 a barrel yesterday. It's close to $120 a barrel in Asian trading this morning. Unprecedented volatility. What does it mean? Well, it means that energy prices are coming down for consumers, but somebody's losing money. Nick McGregor, who's an energy analyst at the stock broker Redmayer Bentley, joins us from Leeds, England, where he's watching the markets. Nick, who's losing money in this crazy market right now?
Well, I guess the producers are losing money based upon the $27 or so a barrel fall in prices, but also quite a lot of the speculators have been caught fairly short by this.
You know, let's talk about the speculators for a moment. There was a rumor that was running through some of the business news channels and some of the blogs that a major hedge fund was unwinding a commodities position that began with oil. Any truth to that? Any sense that there's a particular speculator who may be in some trouble here?
Not that I know of for sure. But then again, one of the problems of this market's been there's been a huge amount of speculation about who's making money, who's playing at the moment. There were rumors that some of the oil producing countries had enormous long positions in the market that were actually creating a self-fulfilling prophecy and driving up prices for them. Most of it all unconfirmed, though.
If enough people get burned here, will it mean that the markets will settle down and that maybe speculators and hedge funds will think twice about getting back into this market and we can maybe plateau at something on the order of $130 a barrel?
Well, I think it certainly reduces the volatility. For a little while, as we ran up to that record $147, the daily movements and the volatility were absolutely vast, as it was seen as a one-way bet. Money was chasing a finite amount of production. Certainly, that volatility is coming down a little bit. We've seen a more stable pricing. But what we've also got to bear in mind is the real thing that will stabilize prices probably is going to be the fundamentals. It's going to be the world getting to the stage where demand is a bit more predictable and there's a better equation between supply and demand.
Well, it's great that you mentioned that. I mean, what this volatility has revealed is a tremendous elasticity of demand. I mean, for the last year, we've been saying continually over and over again that no matter what happened in the West, India and China's demand was going to push this market higher. That was the way it was going to go. As you say, a one-way bet. Now we learn that's actually not the case at all.
Absolutely. And what we're seeing now is the high inflation and lower, we're still very good, but lower than expected economic growth in India and China is making people really question what was seen as a no-brainer up until a little while ago. Accompany that with OECD demand falling really quite sharply as people are responding to those higher prices. And that very, very simple, old-fashioned idea that everything has a price and beyond a certain price, demand will fall is starting to come true again.
There is wiggle room for the consumer, and maybe the gloom and doom discussions need to be revised a little bit, even though we're still in a cautionary period. Nick McGregor, thanks so much for joining us. Nick McGregor is energy analyst, speaking with us from Leeds, England, at the stockbroker Redmeyer Bentley. Adora?
Yeah, isn't that interesting? Conventional wisdom isn't conventional wisdom anymore. But given the volatility of oil prices and the serious energy concerns, it's no surprise the two presidential candidates are hammering away at their proposed solutions. Yesterday, Senator Barack Obama gave a major energy speech outlining ambitious plans to wean the U.S. off its oil dependence in 10 years. Senator John McCain has been hitting back and hammering away at his own proposed solutions, which include the controversial offshore drilling and tapping the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. Will any of their plans work? Joining us now, Andrew Leonard, a Salon.com writer who covers energy and politics. He joins us now from San Francisco, where it's very early. Good morning, Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
Let's put all the daily political sniping aside. Let's start with Barack Obama. You say his plan is far more nuanced than the notion that he's flip-flopped on offshore drilling and the Strategic Petroleum Reserve tapping.
Well, for, you know, well over two and a half years, he's had a really ambitious proposal for addressing the country's energy needs. He's, you know, been pushing very strongly on fuel efficiency, on ramping up solar and wind, on getting fuel-efficient cars out there. And those latest, the concessions that he made yesterday were new. He hadn't yet before talked about endorsing offshore drilling at all or the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. But in the context of his you know, his larger history, he's saying, you know, if we need to make some compromises here to get this larger plan in place, I'll do it. And that's not really a surprising statement from him. He's been making those kind of compromises all along.
McCain came out and described him as changing his positions. Those two specific policies that you've just mentioned, the offshore drilling and the petroleum reserve, both programs that McCain has supported. Tell us about his program.
Well, you know, McCain made this rather, it's funny to talk about flip-flopping because McCain, who had been consistently against offshore drilling, is now going around saying, drill here, drill now, this is the answer to gas prices, in conjunction with a lot of his other, you know, 45 new nuclear plants and, you know, lots of investment in coal. You know, McCain knows, Obama knows, the oil industry knows offshore drilling isn't going to make any difference in gas prices right now or much of it in the future. It, you know, it's been a purely political driven switch.
And that's because essentially it would take 10 years or more to realize any benefit, even if the drilling started tomorrow.
Even if it started tomorrow, it would take a long time. You know, the fundamental problem there is that even if you count everything we've got offshore, the United States has about 3% of the world's oil reserves, consumes 25% of the oil. We cannot ramp up oil consumption to make any difference in the global price of oil.
Does it surprise you, though, that nobody, no candidate, not even the president, is claiming credit for the prices coming down? You know, there's been all this good news. Actually, gasoline prices are falling, and nobody's sort of jumping in and saying, well, I told you this would happen, and here's what we need to do to continue this downward. It seems to be a very tentative kind of toe-in-the-water approach by both candidates here.
I've seen a few people on the right say, well, the prices started going down as soon as President Bush, you know, lifted the executive order on the moratorium on offshore drilling, because that sent a message to the oil markets that, you know, they were serious about expanding oil production.
But that's not really true, is it?
No, it's not true at all. I think what Nick McGregor just said earlier on your show is we have learned in the last year that high prices actually do bring demand down. Americans have drastically changed their driving behavior, and you know the used car market prices for SUVs will tell you that.
Are you surprised by that, Andrew? Because I can recall when we started this show 3 months ago, there was a sense that many thought that Americans would not respond to the high gas prices in the way that they have and as quickly as they have.
I am surprised, and I think a lot of people were surprised. People were talking about, you know, for a long time, people were saying, you can't really cut down. We've already gotten as efficient as we can. You know, people need to drive. And what has turned out to be the case is that we can make drastic changes in our behavior. And I think that is a really encouraging sign for the entire world. It shows that, you know, when push comes to shove, we will find ways to conserve. And, you know, the key is to keep your eye on the long ball and say, you know, what do we need to do in the future that will keep these pressures on and give us alternatives as the price goes up.
Except
and
it's a bit of a political quagmire. I mean, Jimmy Carter, during the energy crisis of the 1970s, you know, embraced this, we're all going to make sacrifices, we're going to together hold hands and change our behavior, and he suffered mightily for it. How does a candidate, you know, sort of engage what's going on in every consumer household with this kind of behavior change and make it a political issue that they can win on?
Well, I think it's really tough. I mean, you can take the easy way out and say, I'm going to solve your problems right now. And when people are, you know, going and filling up their gas tanks and it's costing $80, you know, to fill up the tank twice as much as 2 years ago or a year ago, you know, that pitch makes a big effect. And McCain's been very adroit to jump on that. You know, if you read Obama's speech or you listen to his speech yesterday, you come away with a sense, well, he's got a, you know, he knows the big picture. He's got a plan. You know, everything seems kind of right on a, you know, if you study energy and environmental issues.
Mm-hmm.
However, there's no one-line takeaway like drill here, drill now, I'm going to lower your gas price.
So in other words, it's not simple, not even a little bit.
And McCain,
yeah,
perhaps.
Complexity does not play well for the American electorate.
But are you saying, Andrew, that McCain has the initiative right now in energy?
I think he has definitely got the political initiative.
So his message is a little simpler and easier for folks to grasp onto, right, Andrew Leonard?
I believe so, and I think
thank
that's
you.
Why.
We got to go. We got to leave it there. Thanks so much, Andrew Leonard, writer for Salon.com. He covers energy, politics, and the global economy, and his blog is called How the World Works.
And Andrew, thanks so much for saying the word takeaway. We really appreciate that. We like that a lot. Good morning, everybody. We are teeing up a conversation that we began last week on the news intruding into your table conversation at home. How do kids deal with difficult issues, particularly difficult issues in the news? Say a picture in the news raises some issues. How do you explain it to your kid? We were talking about post-apocalyptic kid literature, but here's what one of you has to say.
This is Marianne Katagan calling from Garber, Oklahoma. And I just wanted to say regarding this apocalyptic issue, it's this kind of a notion that propagates fear over hope. That's a large part of why children want adults out of the picture. They view us as having lost our roles as caregivers who do have real answers.
Thank you, Marianne. She called 877-8-MY-TAKE and left that message. You know, you were talking last week about post-apocalyptic children's literature, but real stories can have just as much of an impact, if not more. Stephen Dubner joins us here in the studio. He's a Takeaway contributor and author of the Freakonomics book and blog. Stephen, thanks for being with you.
Good morning, John Adore.
Now, there was a picture a couple of weeks ago in the New York Times that related to a story in Zimbabwe that we cover almost every day that intruded into your breakfast table conversation. Why don't you pick up the story there, Stephen?
Yeah, a pretty horrific and memorable photograph of a baby with his legs in casts. And it was related to a story that was on the inside of the paper. So all there was the cut line, the caption on the front page. It said that the baby had been beaten by Mugabe strongmen who had been looking for the baby's father because they wanted to beat him up. He was an opposition leader working for the opposition. They couldn't find the father. They threatened the mother with violence against the baby and indeed beat the baby so badly the legs were broken, had to be in cast.
That's what the story said.
That's what the story said.
You were sitting around the breakfast table.
Early, about this time of day, and I'd read it already, and my kids came in.
It was a startling photograph.
Very striking photograph. I mean,
you can find it on our website, actually. There's a link to it on our website.
You see a baby with leg casts, and you know that something bad has happened. It may be illness. It may be a birth deformity. You don't know what it is. So my kids said, you know, what's with the baby? And so I told them. And I did try to couch it in a little bit of a civics lesson. Like, in our country, you know, you can vote. If you decide you want to vote for Barack Obama, nobody's going to break your legs. John McCain, you can vote for Ron Paul. Nobody's going to break your legs, presumably. And yet, in Zimbabwe, that's not the case. So that was the kind of civics lesson in which I couched it. But the story I told was that some bad guys who represented a really bad guy came in and broke this baby's legs.
That's because your children are 6 and 7.
That's true. If they were 16 and 17, we would have had a totally different discussion. The violence itself wouldn't have been the core of the discussion. But as you know, every parent knows deep down, in some way, your primary objective is to be a guardian, right? A guardian against physical damage to your kids. Of all the things that are so difficult in this society about raising children, the one thing we try to do always is protect the kids, right?
But you also need to tell the truth. And what was your child's reaction, first of all, and then what was your wife's reaction?
They were pretty somber, but I'd say they accepted it, right? So if the first stage in any kind of tragedy is acceptance, or actually maybe that's the second stage, they did, but it shook them up. And it shook them up so much so that later in the day they ratted me out to my wife. And they said that we saw this picture, and Daddy said this, and wowie kazowie. And my wife, in retrospect, I think rightly, came to me later and said, what the heck were you thinking? Especially first thing in the morning, the kids wake up and you tell them a story about a baby, an 11-month-old baby being beaten by these guys. Because immediately a kid's mind can jump to the thought that, hey,
it'll
someone can come through my door and beat me.
But so, they saw the picture, so how not address it?
Well, in any case, I mean, that's a great question that Adora asks. And this whole drama sent you off in typical Stephen Dubner fashion to figure out if there was a definitive answer as to what you do in this case. What did you find?
Well, and probably in typical Stephen Dubner fashion, I was unsuccessful in finding a definitive answer. So there's a lot of literature.
Oh, don't be so hard on yourself.
There's a lot of literature on the subject in a variety of different fields, particularly child psychology, as you'd expect. But really, there's no definitive answer. It's a hard question. How do you now? And let me also state this right off the top. This is kind of what you would call a penthouse problem, right? Any family who's having a discussion about how a tragedy secondarily affects their children's lives is not dealing with living within that tragedy itself. So I recognize that, and I don't think we should confuse the issue. Here's the most interesting finding I was able to see. For children who are involved even indirectly, even just as witnesses are reading about tragedies, and there's been a lot of empirical study in this from 9/11, Oklahoma City bombing, on and on. Even indirect exposure can produce a variety of emotional reactions, including post-traumatic stress disorder of a very strong magnitude. And so the idea that you should really shield your children from the brutality of real life does have some significant credence. In terms of how to deal with that, everybody's got different advice.
Yeah, I mean, in my house, Allison, my wife, around the breakfast table, she told our 7-year-old.
Sounds like you and
exactly
I are married
happened
to the wrong people.
Well, no, I'm married, definitely married to the right person. But her idea is, you know, if you see it, There is an answer, and you can come to Mommy and Daddy and find out what happened. And if you have further questions about it, we will help you with that. I mean, I don't know what I would have done in this situation because I was stuck in a studio here. But that was her decision. It was very different from your wife.
Absolutely. We talk about, you know, Hitler is, I think, we play 20 questions a lot in the car. I think Hitler is the most common answer to the 20 questions. Everybody in the family loves to use Hitler because there's so many ways to get at him. Now, the kids know quite a bit about Hitler, but we've come
learning
to him
a lot about Stephen today.
We've come to him through the back door of Jesse Owens in the 1936 Olympics. With the Olympics coming up, the kids read a couple Jesse Owens biographies, and you hear about Hitler as this guy who pretty much hated everybody who wasn't like him. Okay, then you can go to the political section. But because we're Jewish, the idea of the Holocaust and Hitler, we haven't done that monster yet. And we've been kind of building up to it, but it's not easy.
And I guess I asked that question about how do you not address it. I was in Nigeria, living in Nigeria in 1984. I was 16 years old, and there was a so-called bloodless coup, but there were a lot of people who ended up dead up in the north where we lived in Nigeria. And so you'd be riding down the street, and they're just sort of cars with bodies in it. And I can't imagine. I mean, it was very upsetting.
Well, there's no way not to tell you about that.
But the point is, we had discussions in my household about that, and I think about that now, and had there been no discussion, maybe I had been with my friends and not my parents, and they didn't know that I had seen that, that probably would haunt me still to this day, and that was many decades ago.
The great irony, and we should get to this point, is that the Times picture was actually wrong.
It was wrong. It was a bit of a con job.
It was a con job, and that the baby actually had a congenital deformity, and the casts on the baby's legs were to treat that deformity. So, you know, it comes full circle. I actually told my daughter, my 7-year-old Regan, about that, and her question to me was, how come there's stuff in the newspaper that's not true, Daddy?
Oh boy, press critic.
And I said to her, well, you know, that sometimes that happens. And I said, but the Times told the real story, and now we know it. And she said, how do you know that's the true story, Daddy? Well, so there you go. Anyway, Stephen Dubner, stay with us. We have more. We're actually going to talk with someone who engaged us in that conversation last Friday, who has a very interesting post 9/11 story to tell. We'll be back in a second. Stephen Dubner, stay with us.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, August 5th, and we have some headlines for you from Femi Oke. Hey there, Femi.
Hello there. It is 28 minutes to the hour. Forecasters say that Tropical Storm Edward could hit near Galveston, Texas, at near hurricane strength later today. Texas Governor Rick Perry has issued a disaster declaration for 17 Texas counties that could be in the storm's path, but so far no evacuations have been ordered. The New York Times is reporting that Freddie Mac's chief executive, Richard Syron, ignored warnings from as early as 2004 that the mortgage giant was facing problems. Company executives say they sent memos to Syron saying the company could be backing questionable loans that threatened the firm's financial health. And a federal task force is recommending that doctors stop routine prostate cancer screening for men over the age of 75. That's because treatment can do more harm than good in older men, and many tumours grow slowly. And that's a look at some of your main news headlines from this morning.
And you'll love this, Adora. Crude oil fell to $118 a barrel on speculation that Edward isn't going to hit any production facilities, which tees up exactly what you're going to
talk about. Yeah, they are extraordinary times. We're going to continue our discussion about energy issues. And even though it's just midsummer, fall and winter are not far off, and projected oil heating costs for winter heating bills is causing a near panic amongst members of Congress, governors, and advocates nationwide who provide energy assistance funds. As energy costs skyrocket or come up and down, that volatility of it all, it's not just low-income families who are going to be really struggling, they predict. It's the middle class. And the question is, will everyone get some help? Mark Wolf, the executive director of National Energy Assistance Directors Association, is in the middle of all of this. He joins us now from Washington, D.C. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
What are the predictions for an average family heating their home with oil this year?
Well, for the coming year, we're looking at roughly $2,800 to heat your home with home heating oil. That's up by close to $1,000 from last year.
So almost 100%.
Even at $118 a barrel, prices are still significantly higher.
And so you're talking about families facing up to 100% more in heating costs this year.
Well, exactly. I mean, the thing is, last year, It costs about $2,100 to heat your home with home heating oil in the Northeast. This year, it's roughly about $3,200. It's come down about $100 in the last couple of weeks, but still very expensive, you know. And the thing is, it's like everyone knows what it costs to fill up a tank or your car with gasoline, and people are very sensitive to that. But imagine filling up a tank with home heating oil. It's close to $1,000 now. Last year at the beginning of the winter heating season, it was only about $500. So there's been a significant increase in cost. And normally in the summer, you know, history, you know, the last couple of years, it's always been cheaper in the summer to buy home heating oil. This year really is different. This year we're looking at, you know, very high prices, and that's creating a lot of anxiety among people that live in the Northeast.
And let's put that in context, because already some utilities are reporting record shutoffs. And we're in August now. In New York, it's up 41%, and it's up similarly in Colorado and in many other states. What are members of Congress and governors and others, what are they advocating for now? There are programs like low-income home energy assistance program. Now, is that going to be able to deal with the number of people who this winter you're predicting are going to need help?
Well, not at the current funding level. You know, the current funding level is about $2.5 billion a year, and about 6 million families get help through this program. We're asking Congress, and Congress is looking at this pretty seriously, to double the size of the program, not just for this coming year, but also to add another $2.5 billion to this year's funding. At the end of the day, you know, frankly, the ball's in the administration's court. If the administration accepts it, we have more than half the support in both the House and Senate to pass a bill like that. But we don't have two-thirds. We don't have enough to override a veto threat. So that's really what it's going to come down to in September when Congress returns, whether or not the administration decides that they would accept that.
Mark, this is Stephen Dubner. Every time we see a spike in home heating oil over the past 30, 40 years, you see a strange unintended consequences, which is firewood. People start rushing out to put in those wood stoves. The firewood industry booms. Now, there's a lot of most people would argue that there's worse consequences of burning firewood than there is of burning oil in terms of emissions and cancer and so on. What do we know about that? Are we seeing the spike? Where are we seeing the spike? What kind of shape does that have?
Well, we're starting to see that in the far north and northern New England. But you have to remember, a lot of people can't do that. You know, heating oil, it's different than propane. You know, propane is a fuel that's used primarily in rural areas. But what's different about heating oil is that it's used in the cities. I mean, you can't start burning, putting wood stoves in the middle of Boston in an apartment building. So, you know, there are limitations to that. But people are doing, you know, they're not stupid. You know, people are smart. They're already cutting back on how much gasoline they're using, for example. And we are starting to see, you know, cutbacks in heating oil. People are doing every possible conservation measure possible because
But Mark, yeah. one of the things that I think Adora sort of raised a moment ago is that if everyone goes for these alternatives, if suddenly the entire market shifts to take a look at wood or conservation alternatives,
it
makes it really, really difficult. It's easy to benefit if you're just one of a very small number of people doing it, you know, in the Mother Earth news.
Right.
But if everybody's doing it, all of a sudden the prices rise and you're not going to get much of a benefit because demand rules.
Well, if everybody does conservation, you know, not just buying wood, but they close off rooms they're not using, they put in insulation everywhere possible, they tune up their furnaces, then demand will go down, you know, overall for not just delivered fuels, but for natural gas and electricity as well. So I think the thing is people can do that. But again, you know, efficiency and conservation can get you just so far when prices go up this high. And that's part of the problem, that for poor families, you know, they already don't use a lot because last year was expensive. You know, it's not like this is the first year of high prices.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was looking at the numbers, you know, a little while ago that, you know, a typical family, a middle-class family making about $50,000 a year, you know, 5 years ago for gasoline, for home heating oil or natural gas, because then, you know, prices were about the same for both fuels and for electricity, they paid about 5 or 6% of their total income. And that was manageable. And so what a lot of people did was actually cheap. So a lot of people went and bought bigger cars. In many cases, they bought bigger homes because energy just wasn't a big part of their budget. Last year, it hit about 10% of their budget, and I think people started to, cut back at that point. This year, if prices stay this high, for all fuels, gasoline, home heating fuels, electricity, it's looking like about 15% of that family's income. And that's already, I think, unaffordable. They just don't have 15% to buy that much energy.
And so there's
going to have to cut back.
So that national discussion will continue because these are some real problems that are going to need some real solutions. Mark Wolf, thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
Mark Wolf, Executive Director of the National Energy Assistance Directors Association. And we thank him. And Stephen Dubner, a co-author of Freakonomics, is still with us, and he's going to ride along a bit as we move forward.
Some
or
freaky
going
economics
forward.
For
We're not
fall,
supposed to say that anymore, right, John? What? Moving forward or moving forward?
I don't know. I didn't get the memo. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji.
And we're continuing a conversation in the program about difficult issues, particularly from the news when they enter the conversation of young children. Stephen Dubner is with us. He told us the story of a headline picture in the New York Times that caused some sober discussions around his breakfast table. In the discussion we had last Friday about children's literature that evokes a post-apocalyptic world, we heard from Elizabeth Harris from Rockland County, New York.
I'm 17 years old, and when 9/11 happened, I didn't really know what to make of it. Both of my parents worked in the city, but I just kind of had to deal with it, suck it up, every day is a risk. Yet on the other hand, I went to see WALL-E with my mom and found it completely terrifying because it seemed so plausible. And I realized my parents are always going to tell me that everything's going to be okay when I'm 10 years old, because that's what they need to tell me.
Elizabeth Harris is on the line. Elizabeth, you're not 10 anymore. I guess that's the lesson from that very emotional call you delivered to us last Friday.
No, I'm not 10 anymore.
Kind of hurts.
Yeah, it was hard to, watch my mom go into the city every day. My dad goes in maybe 3 times a week and just worry about what might happen. But as time went on, you kind of forget about it. But it's still there.
You witnessed 9/11 in the way that a lot of people who live in the New York area did, being very, very close to that event. So it wasn't like a picture in the newspaper. So the issue was right there in your face. I guess what you're describing in your story that you told on the phone last Friday is over time you begin to learn how vulnerable you are and how the real world actually does intrude with its violence. And I guess, were you surprised that WALL-E was so scary?
I was, because I realized by judging by the audience that a lot of kids were there and maybe they couldn't understand, or see it the way I saw it, but it seemed real that the world could be made out of garbage and humans could de-evolve.
And nobody was sitting there saying it's going to be all right, Elizabeth. What's your advice for Stephen Dubner, who was trying to explain to his daughter recently, what happened in a very, very violent-looking picture in the New York Times from Zimbabwe?
Well, my mom didn't really know what to tell me when 9/11 happened because at the time, nobody really understood what was happening other than just that there are bad people out there, but this is life, and you can't avoid life hiding in a closet or hiding under your bed, and either way, you still have to face what's going to be out there the next day.
Elizabeth, this is Stephen Dubner. I'm wondering, without meaning to nail your parents, is there anything that your parents did or said that in retrospect you wish they hadn't said or did?
I don't know. They're listening right now.
you can tell us, Elizabeth. It's okay.
Well, I guess, they were scared too. But ultimately, these are their jobs and this is how they're going to provide for our family. And they didn't have a choice either. So whether they were just as scared as I was, I probably didn't see it because they wanted to appear strong for me, which in the long run was the way that they needed to.
Well, Elizabeth, I want to thank you so much for sharing that story and your experience when you called last Friday. It was really great for us to hear you, and it's great to talk with you on the air.
Okay, thank you.
And you can reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Really was very, very moving. Thank you, Elizabeth.
We'll see.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. Across the country, school districts are facing some tough decisions as revenues drop in this very tough economy. For many, it may mean cutting sports programs or art programs or music programs or any other kind of programs. In Mount Vernon, New York, many sports have been cut. Sean Harris is a senior at Mount Vernon High School. And Sean, he played basketball last year. And this year, you're only going to get to play varsity basketball if the team can raise enough money to keep your program going. That true? And Sean, how much money does your team need?
We have to raise $1.1 million. The deadline is August 10th. If we don't have the money...
6 days from now.
Yeah, 6 days. We have to raise $1.1 million. We're doing fundraisers, like we're going around the city, stopping cars at lights, asking for any spare change they want to save our sports. Or anything, they could write a $100 check and send it in. We're just trying to do anything so we can have sports.
How did you find out about this? You were expecting to go back to school. You're a senior. You're on the varsity basketball team.
I didn't know about it till about early July. When I first heard about it, I didn't really think nothing of it. But I heard that later in the stage, I heard that it was really serious and. We had a chance of not having sports, but yeah, it's a serious deal.
So they've cut all sports, not just basketball.
All sports, all 22 teams, boys and girls, is cut.
800 students it affects, right?
Yeah,
and many of them your friends. I mean, what are you telling each other? I mean,
we just try and do anything we can to raise money. Most of my friends are seniors, just like me. This is our chance to get scholarships for college and everything. If we don't have sports, then I don't know what we could do.
Your coach told us that playing basketball really motivated you to work harder mm-hmm. in school mm-hmm. and play harder on the court. And you really, he thought that you would have a good chance of getting some kind of basketball scholarship to a college. And now what?
Yeah, my coach, since I've joined the basketball team, that's motivated me to work harder in class and on the court. Even in the weight room, to it taught me how to have determination, and without sports, I don't know, really don't know what I'm gonna do.
Well, Sean, how do you answer the argument? Well, hey, sports are you know a fringe thing; they're extracurricular. It's probably good that you're gonna have more time to focus on academics. What do you say to people who say, you know, the main thing is academics?
Yeah, the main thing is academics, but sports teaches you more than just shooting a basketball into a hoop or anything like that. With sports, it teaches you how to be on time, stuff like that, to prioritize.
Discipline.
Yeah, discipline, basically. For people like that...
Yeah, that 22-second shot clock, you know, when that reaches zero, you can't say, ooh, just a minute, I was late there.
So tell us about this fundraising. How's it going?
About 2 weeks ago, we during the weekend, we went to different places, a Target in Mount Vernon, and we went to a Duane Reade in Mount Vernon, and we stopped at the major lights and the stoplights.
Are you close to your $1.1 million?
I'm not sure where we are now, but we on the 2 days on the weekends we raised I think 19,000 in just 2 days, and I know a guy who a director of movies, he donated 25,000.
Wow!
Just alone.
They have a tough mission ahead of themselves. The students there at Mount Vernon High School need $1.1 million. And Sean Harris, we wish you luck on that. You're going to be busy raising that money. They have 6 days. And now we're going to get some headlines from Femi Oke.
Thanks, Adora. 8 minutes to the hour. Here are the top stories of the day. Tropical storm Edward is gaining speed in the Gulf of Mexico with winds of 50 miles an hour. The storm could be near hurricane strength when it hits somewhere along the Texas or southwest Louisiana coastline tomorrow. The Commerce Department says consumers' personal spending fell by 0.2% in June after adjusting for inflation. That's the worst showing since February. Two American soldiers are dead and another wounded following a roadside bomb in Baghdad. Iraqi officials report that separate bombings killed at least 9 Iraqis. And investigators say they used scientific detective methods to lead them to Bruce Ivins, the biodefense researcher who killed himself last week because he could be indicted on murder charges in the 2001 anthrax attacks. And finally, just wrapping up some Olympic news for you from China, let's do that with this little number here. It's called... I like it. It's very sweet. Welcome to Beijing. It features some of China's most prominent celebrities, including Jackie Chan. Now, China demonstrations in Tiananmen Square happened today. Former residents were complaining about being cleared out of their houses for a strip mall to be built. There was a border raid on China's Asian border, 16 policemen dead. The Pope blesses the Olympics, and protests will be allowed, but protesters have to apply in writing 5 days in advance, so they won't be able to protest on day one if they haven't got their application in already.
Is that a new rule?
Yes, that's just come out this week.
Interesting.
Yes.
There's always rules about protesting in China, that's for sure. Thank you, Femi.
You're very welcome.
We're going to take a few minutes here and check into a very important conference that's opened this week in Mexico City. 20,000 policymakers, scientists, and AIDS workers are attending the Global AIDS Conference in Mexico City. BBC correspondent Duncan Kennedy joins us from that city. Duncan, thanks for being with us.
Good morning from a very wet Mexico City this morning.
Yes, I gather there is good news globally on the AIDS front, but maybe not so good news for individual countries. Explain.
That's right. I mean, the two main headline figures from the United Nations are that the number of people infected around the world has gone down slightly in the last year or so, and so has the number of people who are dying from AIDS. And they're saying, are we now turning a corner after a quarter of a century of this disease? Are we finally getting to the point where we're starting to conquer it? But the problem is, this does, as you say, it hide many individual pictures in different countries. So, for example, in places like Britain, Germany, Australia, China, Russia, the numbers of infections are going up. So a good headline figure, but it hides a very complex picture behind that.
Because of the sort of sexuality-related issues associated with AIDS, also poverty and others, the cultural sort of challenges for nations in dealing with AIDS are varied from place to place. The head of the UN AIDS organization suggested that we are entering a new phase with new challenges of sustainability. What does that mean, Duncan?
Well, he's concerned about the fact that we have this, as I say, headline positive news. And he's afraid that the governments of the world will now be able to relax, take their eye off the ball, and crucially divert resources elsewhere. If governments around the world can say, look, we're conquering AIDS. We don't need to spend so much money, like President Bush spending nearly $50 billion. We can spend that money much better elsewhere. Well, then that causes problems for those sufferers. So they're firing a warning shot. Yes, we seem to be beating it, but there's still a long way to go.
But Duncan, isn't there some discussion there about the report that just came out here in the United States that perhaps we were undercounting by 40% the number of new HIV cases?
I mean, that's come as a real shock. That's playing very heavily here. The fact that something like 40,000 people a year were believed to be infected in the United States, was the actual figure is now well into the 50,000s because of new blood tests, because of the way these things are being reported. And people are saying here, well, if the United States has somehow miscalculated the extent of the problem there, what about in other countries? And that's certainly the truth here in Mexico, where something like 118,000 people are HIV positive, but they think because of the stigma associated and all these other associated problems, that the real figure is much higher. So yes, these are warning shots being fired by these various groups as this conference starts, and it's all to keep the awareness of AIDS very much high.
Duncan Kennedy, thank you very much. Duncan Kennedy is a BBC correspondent in Mexico City, outlining at the Global AIDS Conference challenges for public health workers in monitoring the disease, as well as the technological challenges for attempting to cure and prevent the disease. Very, very complicated story there in Mexico City.
And enormous, not only here in the United States, but all over the world. However, here at The Takeaway, we're always on, and you can catch up with us on Facebook and Friend Feed.
On today's show, we're following the killings of 16 policemen in Xinjiang, China, by two assailants, the latest from the presidential campaign, and how the downturn in the economy affects school sports.
Yeah, not spots. We've been asking you for the book you think have changed the world, and you did not disappoint. Our website is buzzing with people like Richard, who says, I would suggest that George Orwell's book, 1984, so he's with you, John, as a book
that's
that
a
was
book,
influential.
Yeah.
Through a very black satire, he exposes the workings of a totalitarian state. And he would add any book by Frank Kafka as the definitive chronicler of the modern world.
You could add Darkness at Noon, Arthur Kessler. That's a great Cold War book. Arlene's book is Silent Spring by Rachel Carson. It's brilliantly prophetic about the impact of humanity on our fragile, beautiful Mother Earth.
And a very quick update on our 2008 Veep Stakes game. John McCain's number two. SEC chair Chris Cox is in the lead. And over on the Democratic side, you have the governor
of Kansas. Cox is beating Sarah Palin.
I know,
that's
because
big.
she was leading for a long time, but
that
still, even interestingly also, is on the Democratic side, Kathleen Sebelius still leads.
All right.
As
you can join the
game.
The
number one VP candidate for Obama.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
AIDS? Oh, that's that 1993 movie starring Tom Hanks and Denzel Washington, right?
It's good to see you again, Counselor. Judge Tate, Kendall Construction.
Innocuous.
Ah.
How are you? What happened to your face?
I have AIDS.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Maybe Americans have started thinking about AIDS as an old movie from the 1990s. New numbers show that the rate of HIV infections in the U.S. has been seriously underestimated. Public health, private lives, getting beyond the streets of Philadelphia. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, August 5th. The Centers for Disease Control says it's been off by 40% in counting the number of new HIV cases in the U.S. Has the fight against the virus lost its urgency? Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac report that the country's largest mortgagers knew they were handling risky loans years ago. Traveling across China in the year of the Olympics, newfound access, and Green Bay's Brett Favre forcing a franchise to change direction. Those stories are coming up, but first these headlines.
Good morning, Adora.
And good morning to you, John.
Tropical storm Edward is bearing down on the Texas and Louisiana coast, bringing heavy rain and winds near 60 miles per hour. The National Hurricane Center says Edward will probably be near hurricane strength when it hits the Texas-Louisiana state line around midday today.
Powerful storms tore through northern Illinois last night, forcing the evacuation of Wrigley Field, where the Chicago Cubs were playing the Houston Astros. Cubs pitcher Ryan Dempster says the umpires did the right thing by calling the game in the bottom of the eighth inning.
It actually looked like somebody stood above the stadium with a Ziploc bag full of water and opened it up. It really did. You could barely even see right field.
That's rather vivid. The Astros beat the Cubs 2-0. Thousands of people are still without power as a result of last night's storms. The New York Times is reporting that Freddie Mac's chief executive was warned as early as 2004 that the company was buying bad loans. Current and former executives say if the warnings had been heeded, they may have prevented the mortgage giant's current financial troubles. We'll be talking about this a bit more later.
A Pakistani national who is trained as a neuroscientist here in the U.S., Aifa Siddiqui, will be arraigned in New York today. She was wanted for questioning in connection with terrorism cases. She's expected to be charged with attempted murder after a shootout with U.S. troops and FBI agents who were questioning her in a prison in Afghanistan last month. A federal task force is recommending that doctors stop routine prostate screenings for men over the age of 75. They say more tumors grow slowly and that treatment may do more harm than good.
In politics, John McCain visits a nuclear power plant in Michigan. He then heads on to West Virginia. Barack Obama is in Ohio today, where he'll continue to focus on energy. Oil prices have fallen, that's right, just below $119 a barrel in Asian trading. The S&P lost 0.9%. It opens at 1249.
And it's probably going to spike higher this morning. We're talking to you about how to break tragedy to your kids, especially when it's a news story. And we're also talking about Brett Favre. I mean, when your career, your athletic career is closer to the end than the beginning, how do you go out on a high? Give us stories of people who should have retired but didn't.
And we're not saying Brett Favre is doing that.
Oh, gosh.
But
get out.
We want your stories.
877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adore Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. We begin with the market. We know that we're here in the subprime mortgage crisis, but how did we get here? That's a bit of a story. And as the Federal Reserve meets to consider interest rates, where they should go, up, down, the speculation is they will do nothing this week. We want to talk about Freddie Mac, because it appears that years ago, within Freddie Mac, the mortgage lender, the companion to Fannie Mae, within Freddie Mac, there was an individual or set of individuals who were warning that the risks the company was taking were way out of range of the amount of capital the company had to back it. Joining us now is Charles Duhigg, who is a correspondent for The New York Times, who talks about the story of Freddie Mac and its risk assessment inside the company in a New York Times story today. Charles, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So explain, first of all, how this worked. There were people inside Freddie Mac whose job it was to pay attention to risk and capitalization. They were delivering one message, but the head of Freddie Mac was doing something quite different.
Every company has people inside whose job it is to monitor risk. And in 2004, the chief risk officer for Freddie Mac wrote a memo, according to him, that he gave to the chief executive, a man named Richard Syron, warning that the company was buying larger and larger numbers of risky loans, and those loans would pose a risk to the institution. At the time, that chief risk officer said that he asked Mr. Syron to put in place some measures that would limit how much risk the company was taking on, but that Mr. Syron declined to do so.
Now, we should point out that Richard Syron wasn't buying risky loans because he was some kind of a nut. He was buying them because there were extraordinary financial incentives to do so, incentives that he could put on the bottom line in his quarterly reports, correct?
There were a lot of pressures, and I think the two biggest ones were, first of all, the Congress at the time and throughout this period has really leaned on both Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae to buy larger and larger numbers of risky loans as part of supporting affordable housing initiatives. Secondly, you know, from the period of 2004 through about the beginning of 2007, as the housing market was booming, there were a lot more competitors coming into the mortgage marketplace. And so Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae were under pressure to maintain their market shares by buying larger and larger numbers of risky loans because there was just a lot more competition for the really safe loans.
Now, what were the individuals within the company saying that Freddie Mac should do if it was going to continue buying these loans, things that maybe Syron didn't heed the warning of and didn't take action on?
It's a little complicated just because mortgages, and particularly Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, are complicated in and of themselves. But basically, there were a handful of executives that recommended a number of things. First of all, they recommended that the company put a limit on what acceptable default rates they would have on loans that they purchased. Secondly, some executives recommended that they maintain a really thick capital cushion so that they would have a lot of extra money if things started getting bad. And as part of that, in later years, people also recommended that the company raise money by selling new shares of stock. Many of those recommendations, though, it appears, were disregarded.
And as a result, we're in a situation now where Freddie Mac is looking to have the federal government bail it out, or at the very least buy stock in the company and support it as it tries to get through this very, very difficult time. Charles Duhigg, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Charles Duhigg is a correspondent for the New York Times with the story in today's paper about warnings within Freddie Mac that things were way too risky and undercapitalized as we headed into the subprime mortgage crisis. Warnings back in 2004, Adore.
John, we're going to head to Mexico City, where there's some big news coming out of the 17th International AIDS Conference. And this is where 23,000 of the world's most preeminent researchers, activists, health and development experts have gathered. And that includes Dr. Ernest Darko, who's at the forefront of what has been called the most important public health experiment on the African continent today. And of course, Africa has the world's, as a continent, has the world's highest AIDS rates. Dr. Ernest Darko, welcome.
Thank you, Adora.
Now, there's been some interesting reports, the CDC noting that the estimates of HIV incidences here in the United States has been off 40% for more than a decade. There's been talk about strategies for prevention of HIV all over the world and new ways to prescribe antiviral drugs. With all your experience, what have you been most impressed by so far at this conference?
Well, I think first and foremost, I've been most impressed by the concerted resolve that's being expressed from across so many different sectors that I think previously were somewhat fragmented. But in this conference, I think we see everybody finally coming together and saying enough is enough, and we really have to go move forward as a united front and make a difference. Excitingly, also, I think at this conference, I think as we've all heard, the President Bush has reauthorized PEPFAR, which is the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, for the amount close to $50 billion, which is more than a tripling of the amount of finances being made available to tackle HIV globally from the U.S., making it like the single largest country single country to the world program in the history of humanity.
You know, we should note, Doctor. I mean, down there in Mexico City, President Bush is actually something of a popular figure, unlike a lot of other places in the world, right?
Absolutely, and I think with PEPFAR, it has always been, I think, a signature, positive program of the United States.
Let's talk about what can be done with that money. Your program and some of the programs that you've put together in Botswana, for example, have been heralded for many successes there. How have you set up that program, and what do you attribute those successes so far to?
Botswana, I think, is an example of what we can do with these resources. With really good leadership, the country was able to roll out treatment with the triple combination of antiretroviral drugs. And in under 5 years, they're essentially treating everybody who needs treatment and have more or less stopped death from HIV.
In five years?
In a very short time. Yes, in about 5 years. So it can be done. You can really turn the tide quite quickly.
And give us examples of issues you've come across as you address this issue all over the continent, facing individuals that are truly obstacles to public awareness about prevention and about treating HIV.
Interestingly, I mean, despite being 25 years into this epidemic and knowing the devastation, still you have a situation where 75% to 90% of people do not know their HIV status. So that makes it still, we're basically fighting an invisible enemy. We still see people taking huge risks despite knowing information. There's a gentleman I know who lives in South Africa. We have a very high prevalence rate, and he's married and still has 17 girlfriends. Yeah. So this is somebody who has information and doesn't necessarily use condoms with these 17 girlfriends. So it makes you wonder, how do you get prevention right? Because clearly there's other issues at play of a deep social and cultural nature we need to understand better.
And how do you address some of those cultural elements, if you'd give us a couple of more examples, and how do you confront them?
I think it's really going levels deeper than we have currently gone in trying to understand the psychology, the anthropology, maybe even, underpinnings behind why people will put themselves at risk. I'll give an example. Early on, we got so many messages wrong, for example. Early messaging around condom, for example, said that you should use condoms all the time, in particular if it's not your regular partner. And we actually had a situation in Botswana with university students where, for once, we heard the guys complaining that their girlfriends wanted them to take off the condoms. And it was because of this message. Using a condom meant I wasn't your regular girlfriend, so they want you to take it off to prove that I'm the regular girlfriend, so you should use condoms with other people you might be having an affair with. So, we really have to delve deeper, understand the deeper psychology, and start getting the messages right and come up with effective programs that actually work.
You know, it's interesting. The theme of this conference, it sounds like, Doctor, is not so much a lot of specific edicts on you must do this, you must do that. It's a lot of sharing of notes in various different locales of what's worked and what hasn't.
Absolutely, and that's what I think makes this conference different than in the past, that we don't have the same tension between treatment or prevention and the different camps fighting about that anymore. It's really everyone coming together saying, let's try to figure out what really works, because as you may have heard already in the news, we've had more people infected than we got on treatment last year.
Hmm.
We had 2.7 million people infected, and we put 1 million people on treatment. And that's the equivalent of really trying to mop the floor but not turn off the tap and then wonder why the floor is staying wet.
Why it's still wet.
There's the takeaway.
We're going to have to leave it there. Dr. Ernest Darko, it's been a great pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Ernest Darko, public health doctor and country director of Broadreach Healthcare, attending the AIDS conference in Mexico City. It was fascinating. Fascinating.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. The Olympics is coming. The Olympics are coming. The Olympics will be here on Friday, at least the opening ceremony. And journalists and athletes and spectators and all kinds of people who are interested in the Olympics are descending upon Beijing. You know, if you're Bob Costas, you cover the Olympics for NBC from a quiet booth that's high above the venue. If you're Matt Lauer, you cover the events from maybe right in the stands with all the other spectators with a perfect view of the event. But if you're Hugh Sykes, a reporter for BBC Radio 4, you cover the Olympics from a train platform somewhere west of Beijing. Hugh, how you doing?
Hello, John. I'm not in a quiet booth. I'm in a very noisy booth, one of about 15 booths, payphone booths, in the huge railway station at Kunming, which is southwest of Beijing, 2,000 kilometers southwest of Beijing. You're going to have to work out how that is, how long that is in miles. It's very noisy here, and if the sound suddenly of an explosion, or what sounds like an explosion, there is a massive electric storm at the moment, and the rain is beating down on the metal roof. But inside here, it's cozy and warm, and the lights are still on. Every now and again, there's a crash of thunder, but people are waiting patiently on long lines of benches to catch their trains from here all over the country. Here I'm down not far away from the Burma-Myanmar border, the border of Laos, and the border of Vietnam. And we're on our way to Chengdu, which is an 18-hour train journey. We get there at 2 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. It's nearly 8 o'clock in the evening here this Tuesday evening. It is Tuesday, isn't it?
Hugh, explain the mission that you're on there for BBC Radio 4. You're traveling everywhere but Beijing, although your ultimate destination is going to be in the Chinese capital. What is it you hope to see on this journey?
I guess you could call it fear and loathing in Beijing, or avoiding Beijing at any cost. The main objective was to take advantage, in the best possible sense of the expression, of the new freedom extended to journalists during the Olympic period by the Chinese government to go anywhere in the country, apart from Tibet, and interview anybody we like with their permission, which is not a very difficult condition if you think about it. And I've been doing exactly that. Just over 2 weeks ago, I started in Shanghai, managed to get interviews with people who were being forced out of their homes because their homes are going to be demolished to make way for high-rise apartment blocks, and they told me the pros and cons of that. Good, because they're going to get toilets. Bad, because they may lose their communities. I then flew about 2,000 miles west, 5.5 hours on a plane. I think the distance is bigger than the distance from Miami to Los Angeles, to Urumqi in the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region, which borders Russia, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Kashmir. And we went on there to Kashgar, where the events yesterday took place, where 16 policemen, it is said, were killed by Uyghur separatist nationalists. But when I was there, there was absolutely no sense of any kind of tension or build-up to a militant activist attack of that kind. Nothing but friendly welcome in the lovely old streets of the Kashgar old town, and the sound of the call to prayer spreading out over the rooftops of the old city.
Hugh, have you actually really been able to speak to whomever you want to? And tell us about some of those Chinese that you've met.
I've had pretty open access to almost everybody. We had minders on one occasion. We went down to a farm out in the countryside between Kashgar and the Pakistan border, and we registered with the local authority because we wanted to be sure that the farmers that we were going to go and see wouldn't get into trouble for talking to us. So we registered with them, and in effect we invited the minders to come with us so that they could witness everything we did. And the purpose of that particular journey was to go and see the family of a Chinese Olympic boxer, Mehmet Tursun Chong, who has high hopes of winning a gold medal, and to ask his parents whether they were going to go to Beijing to see him box. And his dad said, yep, I'm going to try and go there, and it'll take me 5 days by bus and by train to get to Beijing. We also talked to people about Uyghur nationalism, the strength or otherwise of the feeling in that area for separatism. And one man said to us that the militants have got very little support, but another man said to me, look, the Chinese took this land from us. They took our home. They took our bread. We want it back. I don't like violence, but we need a separatist revolution. We can't have a revolution without blood.
Hugh, very, very quickly.
I know what you're getting at. I know what you're getting at, Adora. In other places, we have to be a bit circumspect. We have to be careful. People are willing to talk to us, but you have to kind of phrase your questions subtly and non-confrontationally. We didn't do any adversarial interviews because that would have been counterproductive.
Well, Hugh, very, very quickly, before we go, what is it you found in common in there, those very different places in China? What is the spirit leading up to the Olympics that is in common for all the people that you've spoken with?
Great enthusiasm for the Olympics almost everywhere. Slight resentment in the far west, which is the Uyghur area, where all the Olympic posters are in English and in Han Chinese, but not in the Uyghur script, which looks like the Arabic script. But it's a small point. Almost everywhere else, the common quality that I have encountered everywhere in this country is kindness, extraordinary kindness, a welcome, a hospitality, a generosity, and an openness to greet a foreigner like me with a microphone, which is an unusual experience for a lot of Chinese people here.
All right, Hugh, that's the perfect cue for me to be completely rude to you and tell you that we have to go. Hugh, buddy, that's my cue to be very unhospitable to you, all right? Take care on the train platform. We got to go.
I can hear you, John. You're very welcome.
Hugh Sykes, reporter from BBC Radio 4. And now we have headlines from Femi. Okay.
Thanks very much, John.
Was that appropriate? Was that inappropriate?
It was. I think he got the joke eventually. I like the way that you just hammered it home until he laughed.
Yeah.
Laugh it. Laugh if it kills me.
Coming it's my up, show.
Yeah, go ahead. And you will be amused. 28 minutes past the hour, actually just gone to past 28 minutes past the hour. The US Geological Survey says that a 6.0 earthquake has hit China's Sichuan province just hours after the Olympic torch relay was held in the provincial capital of Chengdu. The quake hit the same area that was devastated by an earthquake in May. Severe storms blasted Chicago last night, knocking down power lines and disrupting flights. Officials at O'Hare International Airport briefly evacuated passengers off of planes waiting on the tarmac and moved people to the lower levels of the airport. Tens of thousands are still without power. The New York Times is reporting that Freddie Mac's chief executive, Richard Syron, ignored warnings from as early as 2004 that the government-backed mortgage giant was facing problems. Company executives say that they sent memos to Syron saying the company could be backing questionable loans that threatened the firm's financial health. And a federal task force is recommending that doctors stop routine prostate cancer screening for men over the age of 75. That's because treatment can do more harm than good in older men and many tumours grow slowly. That's a look at your national and international news for now.
And we're asking if you're an athlete, when to retire? Stories of athletes who retired well or badly at 8778 My Take.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning on this Tuesday, August 5th. We're going to continue our conversation about all of the news coming out of the 17th International AIDS Conference happening in Mexico City. Some really staggering revelations coming from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention over the weekend. During the conference, they reported that federal officials have been underestimating the number of new HIV infections in the United States by 40%.
5% every year for more than a decade. And joining us now for more and trying to understand this is John Peller, the Director of Government Relations at the AIDS Foundation of Chicago. And good morning, John. Many thanks for being with us today.
Good morning.
Now, it's really stunning to hear 40%. That's thousands and thousands more HIV infections actually happening than the CDC had been reporting for many time. And they attribute it to better blood tests and better statistical models. Can you shed some light for us on that?
Certainly. The CDC's new numbers or new estimates say that there are about 56,000 new HIV infections occurring in the United States annually. That's up from 40,000, which had been the estimate for really decades. And what CDC has done is put into place a system that tests for new HIV infections in individuals. So they're now able to determine if an infection is new or old, and then taking the proportion of those new infections and using that to estimate where new HIV infections are taking place. What CDC is indicating is that the majority of new HIV infections are among African Americans, 45%, and that 53%, more than half, of new HIV infections are among gay men and men who have sex with men. These are clearly the two populations that are most impacted by the HIV epidemic today.
So the news was not suggesting that the epidemic is getting worse. It did a better job, whatever the way that you've just described is a better way of taking a look at what's actually happening on the ground. I guess I'm just a little confused about the distinction there.
I think it's a very subtle one. The CDC has said since 2003 that there's between 1.1 and 1.2 million people living with HIV in the United States. Obviously, in light of these new numbers, those estimates will have to be re-examined, and we'll have to look again at the numbers of people living with HIV.
You said it was a revelation just hearing about hearing that report. Why?
These new numbers put really in stark statistics the number of new cases and where they're occurring, and they'll really allow us to better target HIV prevention interventions and to the populations that need them most. The problem, however, and the challenge we're facing in Chicago and nationwide is that federal funding for HIV prevention, when adjusted for inflation, has been cut by almost 20%. We just don't have the resources that we need to roll out HIV prevention interventions to the populations that need them. And in fact, a CDC official said this week that 80% of men who have sex with men were not reached by HIV prevention interventions
80%.
In the past year.
Wow. John, you know, you raise an irony, it seems to me anyway, looking at the statistics of what's being reported down at the conference in Mexico City, and that is globally there seems to be a net decline in the rate of infection, but these numbers here in the United States are pretty disturbing and negative. And while the U.S. is increasing funding for global AIDS eradication, you point out that domestically it's declining.
It's incredibly ironic. The president just signed the new global AIDS bill, PEPFAR, allocating $48 billion to the fight against HIV and AIDS globally. The international infection numbers are down. I think some of the good news that came out of this CDC data is that new HIV infections are decreasing among injection drug users and among heterosexuals. It shows that HIV prevention programs can work and do in fact work even when the Bush administration's ideology gets in the way. The federal government has banned funding for needle exchanges for almost two decades, and that ban continues today.
So then clearly good news then if you found the infection rates down despite that ban. Let me ask you about
the macro, the big picture here. Clearly in the 80s and 90s, there was this great sense of urgency to work towards fighting HIV, fighting the virus, finding a cure. Does that still exist, do you think, in the same way?
It's a different epidemic today, and certainly the fantastic advent of medications that keep people living with HIV alive means that we have a different epidemic and a different perception of the epidemic today. HIV has also shifted into populations that are less visible. The African American community, and particularly gay men of color, gay black men.
So does this new chapter and these new populations, does it cry out for some kind of national policy, since there's never been that essentially communities have been dealing with this state by state, community by community?
Absolutely. We need a national AIDS strategy, and we're joining in the call for a national AIDS strategy. The U.S. government, when it funds other countries for HIV prevention work, requires them to have a national AIDS plan in place, but we don't have such a plan here in the United States. And we think that such a plan would be a great step towards making sure prevention resources are adequate and are adequately targeted to the right populations.
John Peller, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
John Peller, Director of Government Relations for the AIDS Foundation of Chicago. And now we get the latest headlines from Femi Okeh. Femi?
Thanks very much, Adora. A law enforcement official says that John Gotti has been arrested on a murder conspiracy charge. Gotti has had three criminal trials and in mistrial. John Gotti Jr., excuse me. He's expected to appear in federal court in Manhattan today. In a policy reversal, Barack Obama says the nation should release 70 million barrels of oil from the strategic reserve to combat high gas prices. Obama outlined his energy policy in a speech yesterday. In a similar reversal, John McCain is supporting new offshore drilling as part of his energy plan. President Bush flew into South Korea this morning, and his arrival has sparked both praise and protest. Around 30,000 people gathered in the capital, Seoul, for a prayer service welcoming the president. There are also riot troops standing by just in case of some renewed protests from the months of protesting about the reimportation of American beef. And next hour, I will be back with a story about a cloned dog from South Korean scientists. I know, you can't wait.
Thanks, Femi.
Goody. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji.
And Adora, we've got a story of summer love and music. Hear that? Huh? Chicken. Oh, yeah.
Chickens?
It says summer. On any given summer night, this is the glorious sound of frogs letting loose. Keep it going. It sounds like chaos, but it's music to the ears of frogs. Each of those sounds that you're hearing, one way or another, is actually a song.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Froggy went a courtin' and he did right.
That's not what I was just hearing.
No, that's a more familiar song. But the actual songs of frog calls is now a playlist assembled by University of Nebraska herpetologist Dennis Ferraro for the people of Nebraska. There's now a CD that enables Nebraskan froggy aficionados to identify the little guys, like this one.
Sounds like an alarm clock, John.
It's the Great Plains Narrowmouth Toad, one of 11 different frog songs. That's about how many frogs are native to Nebraska. I mean, you can listen to a singer, right? You know, you can listen in the headphones or listen to a CD, but don't you want to know what the Great Plains Narrowmouth looks like? Of course you do.
Okay.
You can hop onto a website. We'll link it from thetakeaway.org, and you can see pictures of the little fellow and submit your own frog groans, and we'll identify them. Ferraro, the herpetologist, says the amphibian songs go way beyond the stereotypical ribbit, ribbit. And they're complex. They're more Ella Fitzgerald than Janis Joplin.
No,
oh, yeah.
No.
Here, they are. Here's the Plains Spadefoot Toad.
Is he ill?
Well, maybe it is more Janis Joplin, actually.
Yeah, not Ella Fitzgerald.
Actually, it's more James Brown, because only males sing in the froggy world. Did you know that?
No, I didn't.
That's right.
And I'm so much better off now.
And these are all mating calls, love songs, and the louder the better. Female frogs appear to prefer males with louder, more intense calls. James Brown, there you go. Calls are also how female frogs recognize males from their own species, which is necessary for a successful reproduction. Some calls are so loud they can be heard a mile away.
How do they even know this? How does the scientist, how do they know it's a love song?
Because they're mating. Of course it's love. Here, this little guy's call may not carry that far, but it's the northern cricket frog. It's not really James Brown.
No,
it's
not. It sounds painful.
It's kind of Barry White, maybe. A little more low-key.
A little bit, yeah.
Hey, come on over here. But frogs actually have different dialects. There could be a southern and a northern cricket frog, and they would sound completely differently.
I wonder how much time it took to figure this all out. The distinctions.
People spend lifetimes. What do you get trash in herpetology
acoustics
for? Here's one of my personal favorites, the northern leopard frog.
Sound like birds.
They're smooth. They do. They're slender. They're up to 3 inches tall. You know, frogs actually spend an enormous amount of their energy and their metabolism on these frog calls. They're very, very important. And the changes in frog calls indicate broad changes in populations and ecosystems. But this frog call is probably a little more familiar to you.
I recognize this.
It's a love song.
From my childhood.
Sure. So because of Dennis, the herpetologist from Nebraska, you can download frog songs to your iPod from our website. And here, finally, do you recognize this frog call?
That's not a frog call. That would be Barry White.
That is the real Barry White, only
the real,
here
the
on
one and
the
only
takeaway. So maybe we can learn something about love from Barry White and frogs.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, August 5th, and we have the latest headlines for you from Femi Okeh. Hey there, Femi.
Hello, Adora. Coming up to 12 minutes to the hour, President Bush is in South Korea. It's the start of a week-long tour of Asia. He meets with the South Korean President Lee Myung-bak tomorrow. Then he heads to Thailand, and President Bush wraps up the week in Beijing at the opening of the Olympic Games. Freddie Mac's chief executive had warnings the company was backing questionable loans as far back as 2004, according to a report by the New York Times. More than 24 executives say that Richard Syron ignored advice that could have saved the mortgage giant from the current crisis. John Gotti Jr. has been arrested on a murder conspiracy charge. He's expected to appear in federal court in Manhattan today. Gotti's 3 previous criminal trials ended as mistrials. And heading back to South Korea for a press conference. This one comes with scientists from South Korea who've held a press conference for the first ever commercially cloned pet. Now, the pet that's been cloned is a pit bull terrier that's called Booger, and it belongs to American Bernan McKinney. She was so excited to pick up her 5 cloned puppies. Here she is.
These men are geniuses, and what they're doing here is a miracle. It's a miracle for me because I was able to smile again and laugh again and just feel alive again.
And the scientists took a little bit of the flesh from her old pet's ear, and they used it to clone 5 new pets who all look exactly the same. Would you do that for Maxie?
My baby Maxie, my Norwich Terrier. I have 2 of them, Maxie and Listy. I don't know, I have to think about that cloning thing. They're Norwich Terriers, and they're 3.5 years old, and they are lovely dogs, and I am an enormous dog lover.
It's safe to come out again.
I don't know about that cloning, but would love to hear your story. We know there's lots of pet lovers out there. Would you clone your pet? 8778, my take.
Or maybe
would
your
you
man.
Or not? Would you or not? Yeah, let us know what you think about cloning pets. It's an interesting question.
Thank you,
question,
South Korea. We'll
take a look at that, especially if any of you want to put in your thoughts or ideas on that. Meanwhile, we've been talking Olympics, 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 and of course, unless you've been living under a rock, you know that the games begin 8 p.m. on Friday in Beijing. And
15 minutes away from the high-rise apartments that make up Beijing's Olympic Village, the U.S. Olympic team has set up its own facility in part to train the athletes, but also to make them feel, well, at home, at least according to the folks who've been there and seen it. Juliet McCore of the New York Times, she joins us now from Beijing. Thanks so much for being with us, Juliet. And first thing first, how's that air quality today?
Hi, how are you? The air today was a little bit better than it was yesterday, which isn't saying much because yesterday was pretty cloudy and hazy, although that's also saying that I actually got outside today, which I did not. So I'm looking outside and it looks pretty foggy.
Huh. Well, tell us about this special place where there's lots of sunshine for the American athletes, or at least as you describe it in your reporting today.
Yeah, the sun only shines on that particular university where the U.S. is training. It's about 15 minutes away from the Athletes' Village in Beijing Normal University. And, I was kind of pleasantly surprised when I went there because I thought it was going to be a regular Chinese university that's not really up to date and with old buildings. But let me tell you, it's nicer than any other facility I've ever been to, even in the U.S. with the new gyms they're in. So they're all set up there with the food and the video games and
what kind of food?
Really,
you got to be specific. Is it very American kinds of food, Juliet?
It's kind of a surprise. Well, they don't have hamburgers and hot dogs for one. They drew the line there, but they did have yesterday. The meal was fajitas. I think it was a chili rubbed steak, herb encrusted chicken, and string beans with almonds. You know, it's pretty high class. It's not just a regular cafeteria that you just would get in any university in the U.S. So
what did the athletes say about it as they were playing Scattergories or Guitar Hero? I mean, what about it is important to getting their head into what they're doing there at the Olympics, trying to win some medals?
Yeah, I think it's actually the opposite. They're trying to get their head out of, you know, that Olympics mode and just forget about it for a couple hours while they're there. I mean, in the Athletes' Village, it's almost like you can't forget that you're at the Olympics because you're walking around and everybody's from a different country and, you know, people are trading Olympic pins and, you know, everybody's wearing their flag. So it's kind of overwhelming, especially if it's your first Olympics. So they basically go there to kind of forget that they're here, if that makes sense.
And explain to us just finally, very quickly, why the United States Olympic Committee thinks it is so important to set up this American Athletes' Village.
I think it's just because that they can. They have the money to do it. It's about $3 million to set up this village. And, you know, they want to get the most performance out of their athletes as possible. So that means you're not walking around the Athletes' Village all day, you know, trying to talk to athletes from other countries or hanging out in the sun. And, you know, they kind of want to have them in a controlled environment. So, you know, when their time comes and they're, whether they're going to run or swim or whatever, they're going to be ready.
Keep them focused.
Well rested.
Juliet McCore,
yeah.
Hopefully the American athletes will be well rested. Thank you so much.
You're
Juliet
welcome.
McCore reports for the New York Times, and she's in Beijing covering the Olympics. John?
Quickly, before we go, Cliff Saunders is on the line with us from Milwaukee, and I want him to respond to this chanting sound of hysterical cheeseheads. Cliff Saunders, sports talk radio host, 1250 Milwaukee. Cliff, bring Brett back. That's the word from Milwaukee, right?
That's the word from the fans. There have been a lot of websites that have been fired up, like SaveBrettFarve.net or BringBackBrettFarve.com. I would say that they are probably the minority of fans, but they're a very vocal minority, and certainly over the last 48 hours, they are getting their money's worth, that's for sure.
The hype associated with Brett Favre's return to the Packers, and he's going to compete for his quarterback job this season, it appears, is like nothing I've ever seen. But do you think Favre is doing himself any favors with this move, Cliff?
No, he's not doing himself any favors whatsoever. And in fact, the latest is there's now a website report out there that is saying that Brett realizes that he may not actually be able to go through 100% with coming back to the Green Bay Packers because he knows the kind of damage that has already been done to the locker room, where it's literally fractured. You have one half of the team that seems to be on one side of the issue and one half seemingly on the other. So his image has taken a big hit, at least outside Green Bay. There are a very large portion of Packer fans who have called my show and who have said, I'm a Brett backer, but Brett's embarrassing me right now.
You know, in terms of going out on a high note, you know, why didn't he choose the David Beckham route where, you know, you go to the Canadian League or something, take a big contract, you know, save somebody's franchise in another league somewhere and make a lot of money?
Now, interestingly enough, that may be, John, what winds up happening, because it may turn out to be in the end that Brett Favre does get forced to accept a trade to either a Tampa Bay, which could use him, or even the New York Jets, the team that I grew up rooting for, being a native New Yorker, because the Packers, I'm telling you right now, there is no way they trade him to Minnesota or Chicago because they play those teams two times every year. Well, they will never give Brett the chance to beat them twice in a year.
Cliff, we got to go, but if you want to hear some whining on sports radio, you should listen to the Jets fans talking about the possibility of Favre coming for a season of sort of sadness and bad performance. The Jets definitely don't want him, the Jet fans anyway. Cliff Saunders, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
Cliff Saunders, sports talk radio host of 1250 Milwaukee, talking about the Brett Favre issue. You know, going out on a high note, it's an issue for any athlete. My wife actually weighed in on this one and said they told Jimmy Connors to retire, but he didn't, and he came back and did an incredible run at the U.S. Open at age 39.
You know what, John, when it comes to sports, everybody has an opinion, and as for the future, everyone could potentially be right. But here at the Takeaway,
no, everybody can't be right.
No, potentially. No, I'm saying potentially
everybody
someone
can't be right.
No, I said everyone equally, it seems, could potentially be right.
No, you're either right or you're wrong. No, we can't argue about this. No. I'm going to go insane. On today's show, we're talking about the 17th International AIDS Conference in Mexico City and the problem with AIDS here in America. We're also following the rising oil and falling oil prices. We heard again from Frogs and you too.
Yes, we did. And if there's any issue that has you, your friends, your family talking, tell us about it. Here's the takeaway for today.
That's not Barry White. That's Frogs.
That's Frogs. Yeah, there's the takeaway for you.
A serious response. Pez on our website says, how can you quantify an age to expose children to ugly realities? That was a conversation we had with Stephen Dubner this morning. Don't kids develop emotionally at different rates? That's absolutely true. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.